Hi, my name is Eric Puchner, and I'm the author of the new novel, Dream State.
Eric Puchner's second novel, Dream State, is a character-driven story that spans multiple generations, beginning with the wedding of Cece and Garrett. The epic follows the course of their lives, but also imagines a not-so-distant future in which climate change directly affects the American landscape as we know it. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Eric Puchner. Maybe we should begin by giving a brief description of Dream State to our listeners. Do you have an elevator speech for it?
Sure. Dream State centers around a beloved lake house in Montana and spans about 50 years in the lives of two friends and the woman they both love, tracing how a stunning betrayal goes on to haunt all three of their lives and the lives of their children.
I received the pitch for this book back in October, and these lines from the email I received from your publisher stuck with me. How do the impetuous choices we make when we're young shape the course of our lives? How do we navigate a world in which our private mistakes, the mistakes of society at large, feel increasingly irreversible? And can we find meaning and happiness in a dying world, one that feels more and more like a dream? So you just described Dream State, the book, but talk to me about Dream State, the feeling.
Sure. And I'm glad you recited those lines. I mean, I think those are lines that I wrote myself trying to capture the feeling of the book and the themes of the book. Obviously, it's much larger than the plot, that the elevator pitch that I just described. And I'm also glad you mentioned that because, you know, people ask you what your book is about, and there really is no answer because a novel is about the experience of reading it. I mean, there's no other way. It's kind of ineffable. You can't really describe it any other way. But yeah, I am interested in those questions, both the sort of like private, personal mistakes that we make and how those have ramifications that maybe get passed on to the next generation, but also the more public mistakes that we make and how those also get passed on to the generation below us, and specifically our failure to tend for the earth. So those two things actually achieve a kind of like meeting point in the second half of the book.
I want to talk about that for a second, because one of the areas you touched on was climate change, global warming, fires. As readers returning to this lakeside house in Montana every summer, we are able to, you know, quote unquote, witness the receding waterline, the rebuilding of docks further into the water, the death of orchards and raspberry bushes. The fires in the book seem prophetic, but also not surprising. Why was this topic important to the book?
Well, the book is based on an actual house. I mean, nothing, the book is a novel. So there's no autobiographical elements in terms of the characters and what happens to them. But it's very much based on a real place, and a place that my wife and I have been going to for the past 25 years, which is a lake house on Flathead Lake in Montana. The town in the book is called Salish, Montana, but the closest town to the real life house is Big Fork, Montana. It's not far from Glacier National Park. So it's a place that's just incredibly near and dear to my heart. It's my favorite place on earth. And so one of the things that's been happening over the course of the past 25 years is that we've watched the environment change, and we've watched the wildfires get steadily worse. And they're not just wildfires in Montana, but also the wildfires in Oregon and Washington and all that smoke, Canada, all that smoke drifts eastward, as you probably know. So there have been times in the past, I would say 7 years, when we've gone out there and we haven't even been able to go outside for 3 or 4 days because the air quality index was so high that it was dangerous. So it's really impacted not only our lives, but impacted the state of Montana in a kind of profound way. So I wanted to write about that. And that all comes from kind of personal experience. And, you know, honestly, I thought I was projecting into the future a little bit, and I am in the book, but I wrote it before the LA fires. And there's a chapter in the book set in LA, and the Hollywood sign has burned up, and the Griffith Observatory has partly burned. And that was supposed to be 10 years from now. So yeah, I mean, I don't think it's prophetic, though. I mean, we all knew that this was not going to happen, but was already happening.
This book was epic in scope, and I suppose this is a question about craft. I want to ask about the timeline of the novel, how you approach time. Not the there before you know it idea, but the jumping ahead of years in a single chapter, sometimes through a single paragraph. In fact, this line was at the center of when I noticed a major jump in time. They moved through summertime, in which days were really years. As the author, you know what happens to each of your characters at the various stages of their lives. How do you decide how much and what to share with the reader?
I mean, that's a really good question. And I will say a couple things in regards to that. First of all, actually, no, I didn't know what was going to happen to these characters. My first drafts are very exploratory. That's what keeps writing interesting for me, is when characters start to do things that I wasn't expecting, or things happen to them that I wasn't expecting. So there's a real, writing a first draft for me is a real act of discovery in that way. There's a famous quote by E.L. Doctorow, who said that writing a novel is like driving at night in the fog. You can only see as far as your headlights. And that's certainly been my experience of this is my second novel, the two novels that I've written, but also why I love to write them, because they're continually surprising me. But the second half of the book, those elisions that you're talking about, where it jumps through time, that was very much purposeful, something that I was part of the design of the book from the beginning. I wanted to cover a large swath of time. I wanted to cover 50 years because I'm interested in time. I'm really interested in books in which time is the antagonist. They move me for some reason in a way that I can't fully explain. Probably I'm not the only one who feels moved by the fact that time keeps marching on relentlessly forward. But there's something about that that sounds depressing, at the same time that the fact that time is, that we're impermanent, that houses are impermanent, that landscapes are impermanent, is also one of the reasons why we cherish them and find them beautiful. So I sort of wanted to capture those two things that seem oxymoronic and seem opposites to each other at the same time.
Summertime, that I just mentioned, was the name of one of the sections. And I believe, if I remember correctly, there were five sections. So in talking about the structure of the book, why these divisions? I mean, was there a purpose for the five divisions?
Yeah, another good question. So originally, the only thing that I really knew about the book was that it was going to be set at this particular lake. I knew what the setting was. It was a setting I cared deeply about and wanted to write about. And I had been to a wedding in which the entire wedding party got norovirus. I was actually officiating the wedding. And so, you know, norovirus is this horrible, it's been going around this year. It made a huge comeback this year, but it's this really horrible sort of like 2-day virus where, you know, you're throwing up and other things and you can't really leave the bathroom. So anyway, at this wedding that I was officiating, one of the flower girls threw up on her way down the aisle and comes on very suddenly. And the groom was so sick, he had to sit down in the middle of the vows. So I felt like this, the first part of the book was going to head to that. It was going to be a kind of event, that event. And it was going to be the fulcrum of the book on which sort of the book pivots. And so I knew that was happening. I knew everything was going to be different after that wedding. I just didn't know completely how it was going to be different. In terms of the five different sections, that was actually something my wonderful editor, Thomas Gebremedin, at Doubleday helped me with. I had I had three sections originally, and he pinpointed particular places that he thought it might be good to let that sort of chapter, the end of that chapter, resonate for a little while, by ending a section and starting a new section. And then I came up with titles for each of the sections that I thought added something to the book that resonated in a metaphorical way.
I want to tell you about when I started reading the book. I came across the name Cece, and I circled it with my pen and, you know, drew a little happy face in the margin because my youngest daughter's name is Cece, and she's getting married June to a guy whose name is Garrett.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
You know, this novel feels, it felt extra personal as I read it, but I don't think it had to do with the familiarity of the names. This was an epic story, but also such an intimate look at life.
Well, thank you. I promise it's not actually about your family in any way. I've never met you, but yeah, I mean, I'm interested in character-driven fiction. I'm interested in character itself. And I think, you know, I teach writing. That's sort of my day job that helps pay the bills. And I love to teach, so I don't mean it that way. But one of the things that my My students are always like really impressed when something really wacky happens in a short story or in a first draft, when like a bear starts tap dancing or something, and they always say, "Oh, there's so much, that's so imaginative." And you know, that is imaginative, but true imagination for me is capturing a fully dimensional human being on the page that just lives and breathes on the page in all his or her or their complexity. I mean, that's real imagination for me, and that's what I've always wanted as a reader, and it's what I aspire toward as a writer.
You know, I was going to ask about something like that because I underlined so many nuggets as I read and places that made me laugh or what made me nod in agreement or think. Like this one, life was a long, incompetent search to get back to a feeling you had when you were six. Or when Lana told Jasper that his face looked like a door and said, "I can't be the first person to grab your face. It was basically designed for it." Or this thought from Cece, "Marriage, the only adventure open to the cowardly." So do you find that your writing is a reflection of your own truths, of observation of others, of the pure imagination you just spoke about, or all of the above?
I mean, I like fiction that makes fresh, funny, original observations. I mean, sensibility is one thing that really draws me to a book. I love those books, and I'm not claiming to have written one, but I love those books in which it feels like someone has opened a secret envelope in your brain and is articulating things that you always knew but never really articulated to yourself. That's the sort of magic thing that my favorite novels do. So, I mean, that's what I love, and I love those quirky little observations. You know, the critic James Wood calls it thisness, when you like have a detail that's so perfect it feels like it has to be from life, even though it isn't. And that's really what I love to read and what I love to write. I mean, I love to write sentences, and if I can say something in a way that I have never heard it said before, that gives me great pleasure.
Dream State is your second novel, but you also have a couple of collections of short stories. And I'd like to hear your take on, you know, writing short stories versus writing a novel. Which form is more challenging for you, and do you have a preference for one over the other?
I love the short story as a form. It was sort of my first love. I mean, the first literature that I fell in love with were short story collections by Ray Bradbury and by Hemingway. And then as I got older, Joy Williams and Raymond Carver and Amy Hempel and all these writers. It's a really kind of special form that, you know, people say has more in common with poetry than fiction in some ways. It has to be super economical, and it's evocative, and it ends with that sort of feeling that Chekhov talked about, that feeling of eternity, like not irresolution, something that just continues into the distance. And I'm really drawn to that open-endedness of the short story. That said, I love, especially with this second novel, there's something about just the, I wouldn't say the forgiveness of the novel, because it's very hard to write a novel, but just the expansiveness and the not having to worry about everything being, you know, perfectly economical, and being able to go off on tangents and being able to observe the world in ways and not worry about whether it's contributing to the story. And it just gives you a little bit more freedom in terms of craft. And I also just love living with the novel's characters for multiple years. I mean, with a short story, you have to start a new story every few months, and or possibly, you know, and stories take a long time as well. So with a novel, I just loved having all those voices of all those characters in my head for so long, and going for a run and being like teleportation, where I return home and have no recollection of running, but I have the next chapter mapped out in my head. It's a great feeling as a writer.
You mentioned your day job a minute ago. You teach the writing seminar at Johns Hopkins. Is there a piece of writing advice you like to pass along to your students?
I don't know if there's a single piece of advice. No, I do sometimes have students who come into my office and they ask me that dreaded question, do I have what it takes to be a writer? Do I have the talent? And you know, I have no idea whether that person has the talent. It's very hard to know at that age, whether someone, not just really the talent so much as the doggedness, because that's what's required. Some of my classmates in grad school who went on to publish books weren't necessarily the ones that I thought would go on to publish books. They were just the ones who didn't give up. and were able to steel themselves against rejection, because there's a lot of rejection when you're a young writer out there. But I ask them, when they ask me that question, I say, well, do you love sentences? And if they give me a perplexed look, I think inside, I don't say this, I think, yeah, I don't think maybe you're going to be a writer. But if they talk about how much they love sentences, then I think, well, you might be.
I don't need my books to be happy. In fact, I think I prefer if they're not. But I feel like I've been walking around in a dream state since I finished your novel. Do you have a hope? Is there something you want readers to take away from the book?
Well, I think walking around in a dream state is a pretty good reaction. I mean, that's what a writer would want, right? You want to write a book that changes somebody, even in a small way. And ideally, you write a book in which you change somebody in a small way forever. I mean, that's the secret goal, isn't it? I do like books that kind of wreck me emotionally, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way. I mean that in the best possible way. I really like to be wrecked. So if someone says that they cried during reading, cried in a way that didn't feel manipulative or sentimental, then that's really sort of the highest praise I think I can hear as a novelist.
Well, the book is Dream State. Eric Puchner, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it was really my pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was Eric Puchner, author of the book Dream State, which was published by Doubleday. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.